Welcome to Meet the Writers. My guest today was born and raised in Washington, D.C. She's written 8 novels and edited 2 short story collections. Her second novel, Girl with a Pearl Earring, sold 5 million copies worldwide and was made into a film starring Colin Firth and Scarlett Johansson. She's also curated 3 shows in galleries or museums. Tracy Chevalier, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Now, you've been in Britain for over 30 years. Why did you come?
Folly. It was folly. When I was a junior in college in the States, I came here for a semester studying English lit, and I fell in love with London. And then when I graduated a couple of years later, I knew I wanted at the time to go into publishing, and that involved moving to New York. And New York was just too strange and crazy and scary a concept at the time. And instead, I discovered that you could get a work permit for 6 months to, if you were an ex-student, to come to London. So 2 friends and I did that just for fun. And, you know, I worked as a temp, typist, and secretary. And then, and my friends, like one worked in Harrods at the bacon counter. Somebody has to. And so the other worked at the Chelsea Kitchen on the King's Road. It was an institution now shut. But we had a great time. We went to the theater, and I loved spending time in London. And then I just kind of, they went back, and I ended up staying. And then I got a job in publishing. And I thought, before you know it, 6 or 7 years had gone by. And I realized that I ought to stay. And but up until that time, probably the first 7 years here, I didn't ever buy books or have bookshelves because I was always sure I was going to be going back, and I didn't want to accumulate stuff. Mm. And finally, a friend said to me, you know, maybe you should just tell people you're staying here, because otherwise people are holding you at a distance because they think you're going back. And so I immediately went out and bought bookshelves and filled them with books.
And then went and studied writing because you're a graduate of the famous University of East Anglia creative writing course. That's produced many of our finest writers here. Do you think that anyone then can learn to be a writer if you go on a course like that?
I think you can certainly practice being a writer. It's a funny question. People are always asked this. There's somehow this assumption that if you ought to be able to naturally write, why would you ever have to do any classes in it? But nobody ever asks that of a violinist or a dancer. Of course, you have teachers and you have practicing, and where somehow writing is meant to well out of nowhere. It doesn't. You need exercises and you need deadlines and you need a critical audience to say, yeah, that works, that doesn't. Have you tried it this way? For me, that year was really good because it was like drawing a line between my life before that had been primarily as an editor and then sometimes writing, squeezing it into the little corners of my life when I had time. And that year, I placed writing front and center because I think you learn how to write by writing. Mm. And it sounds obvious, but somehow it doesn't seem that obvious to people. You write, and sometimes you need a course to say, okay, here's your deadline. Here's what you need to do. Here's the thesis you need to write. And that really made a big difference because I spent the whole year doing nothing but writing. And so I did get better. I think a creative writing course can get you so far, but there is that little spark beyond that, the fairy dust that's sprinkled that you don't have any control over. You either have it or you don't. And I think that's true of musicians too, and painters and other artists, that you can get very good at, say, playing the piano if you practice several hours a day and you have a good teacher, but you may never have it in you to become the concert pianist. So I think a creative writing degree is a similar ideas, that it can take you as far as you can get through sheer hard work. And then there's that extra something that comes from somewhere else.
Yeah. It'll hone your skills. It'll also give you the industry contacts. How easy was it to get The Virgin Blue, your first book, published?
It was not as hard as I thought it would be. And it was exactly for that reason that I had contacts. I had done the MA at UEA, and that did open doors. What happened actually was a guy who was on my course named Martin Bedford, he's now a young adult writer, He sent his finished novel a year or two later, after the course finished, sent it to Curtis Brown, to what they call the slush pile. It's a room full of jiffy bags full of manuscripts. And this assistant to an agent named Johnny Geller fished around in the slush and found Martin's manuscript and read it and said to his boss, "Do you mind if I try selling this?" So I said, "Go, knock yourself out. Go ahead." And he did. He set up an auction and sold it for £100,000. And I had just finished The Virgin Blue, and when I heard this from Martin, and it made the newspapers, it was a big deal at the time, and I wrote to Johnny and said, and they immediately made him an agent because he had been an assistant, but he was an agent with no clients. So I wrote to him at just the right time, and I said, "I've finished a book. Can you do what you did for my friend Martin?" And he read it and said, "Yeah, I can sell it." He sold it for a lot less than that, I have to admit. Much less, but that's okay. It was a foot in the door. So that was how it started.
And then, of course, it all changed. You really came to the public attention with your second book, The Girl with the Pearl Earring. Now, of course, that comes from the Vermeer painting. You gave a great TED talk about gallery fatigue and storytelling.
Yeah. It's funny. Somebody just before I came in to talk to you mentioned the gallery fatigue issue. And he said, "Oh, I have that all the time. And it makes me feel so guilty." And I said, "Yeah. And what comes after the guilt of going around a gallery and feeling guilty that you're not responding to anything? After that, you feel angry that you're feeling guilty. You shouldn't have to feel guilty about not responding to a work of art." And it's odd about painting in particular, I think. We somehow think because a curator or somebody has taken a painting and put it on the wall that we are meant to say, "This is really amazing." Mm-hmm. When actually, with most other things, if you're listening to pop music on a radio station, you don't like every song. You're not really expected to like every song. Nobody would be surprised. And books as well. You think, "Oh, I think I like that book, but no, that book doesn't sound like it appeals." And that's perfectly acceptable. But somehow you go to the National Gallery and you're meant to like everything there. And that's really, really unfair. So my advice is always go into a room, have a very brief look around, and just stop at the painting, the one painting out of 20 or whatever it is, or out of 100 that actually speaks to you.
Mm. Obviously, that painting did speak volumes to you.
Yeah.
And you've talked about imitating Vermeer's painting style, but in words. How do you even begin to go about that?
Well, I think that Vermeer was of the school of less is more. He would focus on one corner of a room. Usually it was one person in the painting, often a woman performing some sort of domestic activity. So she'd be pouring milk or putting on a necklace or reading a letter. And in x-rays they've done of his paintings, they've noticed that there are all kinds of changes that Vermeer makes, mostly taking things out. So there would be a painting hanging on the wall, and he would just scrape it off or paint it out, paint over it, and so that there's just a blank wall. Or there might be a blank wall with a little nail sticking out where the painting would have been. That's quite clever. And I love that, the fact that the less that there is in the painting, the more you focus on what's there. And I've applied this to many aspects of my life. Like, I wear a lot less jewelry than I used to. When I was my teens, most teenage girls wear a lot of jewelry. They'll wear earrings and a ring and a necklace and, lots of necklaces, lots of bangles. And for me, it's enough to wear just earrings. Like today I'm wearing earrings and, last minute put on the bracelet. I might even take it off because Coco Chanel said the last thing you put on just before you go out of the house, take it off again. Mm-hmm. We often sort of get ourselves ready and we're so prepared, and then suddenly we shove a scarf on because it's by the door and it completely ruins the look. You just don't need all that stuff.
Yeah.
Vermeer didn't need all of that. And when I was writing, I thought, what can I take out of this sentence and still have it work as a sentence? Often it would be adverbs to start with, sometimes adjectives, and also just things that are unnecessary that actually, when you take those out, it makes the words that are left much crisper and more meaningful.
So in terms of your process, are you just sort of writing everything down and then you'll go back and take those out? Or are you thinking about it sentence by sentence in that way?
I'm usually thinking about it sentence by sentence because I tend to write quite short. So I'm obviously already like censoring myself or editing myself as I'm writing. But having said that, I go through lots of drafts of looking at each sentence and pulling words out. Mm. So the books get shorter and shorter as I go on, although sometimes obviously you have to add things in too. But for the actual style, I pulled things a lot. And I learned also from a poet friend who read a first chapter of, actually this is the Virgin Blue. He read a chapter and he just said, "Why do you need this? Why do you need that? Take this out." There's just red ink all over it. And it was quite painful at the time, but I learned a lot just from that one experience.
When you're writing yourself, can you read other people? I've been struck by the very detailed reading lists that you keep, mostly female authors, it would seem. And I just wondered how reading other people informs your own style.
I am the world's worst accent. I cannot do other accents. This is how I sound. I'm not much good at. I could never. I've lived here 30 years. I still can't do an English accent. And I'm kind of the same with writing. I really admire writers. Like I really admire Margaret Atwood's writing, but I could never actually sound like her. I love Sarah Waters' work, and I think she writes such beautiful limpid sentences. And I just think, how do you do that? How can I do that? I'll read a sentence and just think, I wouldn't even know how to begin to write that sentence. So I'm not at all good at imitating, which means, luckily, it means I can read while I'm writing. Although I know there are a lot of writers who just don't read anything while they're writing, but that's never been a problem for me.
You say, of course, 30 years, still haven't picked up the accent. You did pick up a British husband, though. Now, he's a trustee of the Woodland Trust. And together, you've come up with a wonderful tree-based project, Why Willows Weep.
Yeah. The Woodland Trust contacted me at one point and said, "Is there anything you think that writers could do to help us?" And the Woodland Trust is a UK charity that helps to that promotes planting UK native trees. We're a very deforested country compared to the rest of Europe, so they try to plant, replant, and save old forests. And I thought about it and I said, well, what if we took the 23 native UK trees and gave writers a choice of one tree? They choose one tree from that list and write a fable about it. So they've written these short fables, just two or three pages long. I sent them an example. Mine was Why the Birch Has Silver Bark. And let's see, it's been a while, but Maggie O'Farrell wrote about oak and Philippa Gregory wrote about holly. Richard Mabey wrote about beech. William Fiennes wrote about the ash. So it's mostly UK writers. And we made it into a volume to sell to raise money for the Woodland Trust.
And was that work with the Woodland Trust part of the inspiration for your new book, which is called The Edge of the Orchard? It's about a pioneer family on the American frontier, as seen through its relationship with trees.
Yes, I grew more and more interested in trees. My husband had been talking about them to me for a long time, and when I was writing and then editing these fables about trees, I started thinking how interesting it would be to write something longer about and actually have trees be a kind of a character in a novel. Mm. And so that was part of the genesis of At the Edge of the Orchard.
And you show in the book, at least I feel, that trees and people can be transported great distances, but neither do well on top of each other.
Exactly. Well, when you think about it, a small tree can't grow up to be a tall tree or a mature tree in the shadow of its parent because the shade would kill it. So trees only succeed, or they only grow if they are a little bit further from the parent tree. So they either get taken by the wind or by a bird or for some other reason taken up further away and grow that way. And I think the thing about trees that I hadn't really understood until I started researching this book is how much they have moved themselves in the world. You know, humans have moved for thousands of years. We Homo sapiens originated in Africa, and we have migrated all over the world. It's what we do. But so have plants, and so have trees. So if you think of an apple tree, you think of apple trees in England, they seem like they've been here always, but they've only been here since the Romans. Mm. They originally came from Kazakhstan and then moved east through Persia and then down towards Italy, and eventually the Romans brought them over here. And then English settlers brought them over to the States. So even something as fundamental as an apple tree is actually a migrant, you could say. Mm. He's an immigrant. Mm.
In the book, one of the main characters is addicted to apples. One gets a sense that you might be too.
Yeah, I did eat quite a lot of apples while I was writing this book.
Now, it's set in Ohio, and your previous book, The Last Runaway, was also about Ohio. So why? Why Ohio?
Well, when I was researching The Last Runaway, I had this tree thing with the Woodland Trust in the back of my head. And I was also reading about, to get some period detail for The Last Runaway, I was reading about Johnny Appleseed, who was a man in 19th century Ohio who spread apple trees throughout the region. And one of the things I read about him was I grew up knowing him from kids' books as this sort of lovable, crazy guy who wore a tin pot on his head and a sack for clothes and went barefoot and talked to the animals and promoted apples as healthy eating. And actually, he was a businessman who quite cannily figured out where settlers were going to go in Ohio, planted trees, apple trees there before them, so they were ready to be transplanted to these settlers who needed. One of the requirements of settling in Ohio is you had to grow an orchard of 50 trees. So he was waiting for them, and he made money off of all of this. It wasn't about healthy eating. Mm. But even more than that, he grew apple trees from seeds. Most apple trees grown from seeds, as opposed to being grafted, end up having sour apples. And you use sour apples not for eating, but for drinking. You make cider and brandy, apple brandy, from them. So there was this strange contradiction in the folk myth that grew up around him and the reality. And it made me think of a family who have to plant this orchard, and the husband wants sweet apples that he's brought branches from his... They come from Connecticut to settle in Ohio. And he wants these sweet apples that are originally from England to eat. And he calls golden pippins. And his wife, Sadie, wants sour apples to drink because she wants to sort of obliterate, get away from the difficult life they're leading. Mm-hmm. So it's the story grows out of that.
The conflict at the heart of the book. One gets the sense of such an enormously tough life. I mean, clearing land for the graves, yeah, of his children before they've even died, because he thinks he's not going to have time to do it when they inevitably succumb, yeah, to swamp fever. And I mean, even the 12-year-old Sel, seeming to acknowledge the futility of it all, shrugging because she knows there's no good caring about anything too much. I mean, I wonder if you get affected writing about the kind of grinding relentlessness of it all.
Well, I think that's why only half the book is about the grinding relentlessness. We got to get out of there somehow. And one of them does. Robert, the youngest child, is affected by this battle between his parents, and he ends up going west. And half of the book is set 15 to 20 years later in California during the gold rush. And the book in a way is about the American dream and this idea of leaving your troubles behind by moving west, mm, and looking for land, looking for freedom. And for Robert, he's tempted to go to California because gold has been discovered there, and everyone thinks, oh, you can make your fortune there by just doing a little work and finding these nuggets of gold. You just reach into the river and you'll find them, and then you can retire and go back east and bring all this money back to your family. Well, the reality is that's not really what happened. A lot, I mean, thousands, hundreds of thousands of people poured into California looking for gold. And some of them became wealthy, but a lot of them gambled it away, drank it away. or ended up spending it all on the inflation that surrounded them. Mm. So the people who made money were actually the people who supplied things like shovels and pots and horses and oats and things like that. But Robert goes out there as well, and then he turns away from the gold because he realizes it's a false hope, and he ends up among a different type of tree from apple trees, wild trees, the redwoods and sequoias of California.
Yeah. Now, he's a man who doesn't want to give names to things. The names are very important. The good enough name is the name of the family.
Can you imagine having the name good enough? I mean, it's just such a burden to have. Nobody expects much from you.
Absolutely. But he, Robert, refuses to give, I mean, he won't even give his horse a name. And actually, when he finally does, that name's rejected.
Yeah, I think names are really important. They're important to me. But for Robert, to name something means you care about it, that you care about it not enough that you don't want to lose it. Mm. And so he, his first horse is stolen. So he just thinks, well, a horse is a horse. And actually, that's not the case. Mm. And so there are other things he has to name as well in the book, which we won't say. It gives too much away.
But spoiler alert.
But there are names become very important.
Yeah. But I mean, talking about losing things, losing people, losing animals, it's very interesting looking back at our attitude to death, because of course, you've written about this before in Falling Angels, that unpicked the length of time that people had to spend in mourning for different relatives. I think that was Edwardian England, wasn't it? But here, in this very tough, pioneering time, death, not even from natural causes, but even murder, seems to be treated incredibly casually.
Yes, that's part of the frontier life. Yeah. There is a lot of death around in children at that time. To reach the age of 5 was a sort of miracle. That's why there were large families, because people had a lot of kids. It wasn't just that there wasn't much birth control. It was also that if you had a lot of kids, then you could, it was a kind of insurance policy against losing them. And the good enoughs lose 5 out of 10 to start with anyway, and more to come, I'm afraid. But it's a tough, you can very easily get sick where they live in the Black Swamp. People get the swamp fever every August and from the mosquitoes. And there's usually somebody dies. Mm-hmm. And this I based on not just fanciful, but actually on research, that the infant mortality rate was really huge. And so you live with death so much that it isn't quite as shocking as it would be to us.
Yeah. And yet, eventually, the relationship between the surviving siblings is really, really intense. It made me wonder if you have siblings, and if your relationship to them, or generally does one's relationship to one's siblings, change with age?
I think it does change. I have an older brother and an older sister. And my brother lives in Colorado, so I don't really see him much. And he and I are quite different, although we get on well. But my sister and I are more similar. Actually, we sound exactly the same. It's really weird. Even I know that. And I can hear it. And she lives in France, so I see a lot more of her. But when we were kids, she was 5 years older than me and just hated me following her around, as you know, as a younger sister would do. And so she wanted nothing to do with me, or just saw me as like, oh, younger sister. But that, of course, changes as you get older, when you both have kids, when you both are much more adult. And so, yes, we're very close now.
Mm. I know that you have one son, and I wanted to talk about another famous only child in fiction, Desdemona from Othello. And, of course, you're right in the middle of the Hogarth Shakespeare project, where you're reimagining Othello. Tell me about that.
Yes, I think Othello is a play about being the outsider. And about bullying, actually. So I thought, where do you find those two things the most? Well, you find them all over the place. But I decided to set it on a school playground, circa 1973. So it's around the same age I was. And the kids in this are all 11 years old. They're all in their last year of elementary school or primary school. And it's a time when kids like get together, a boy and a girl get together at morning recess, and then they break up by lunchtime. So it's not so much about love, it's about trying out the templates of what it means to be adult. And so the book is about that, but it's also about being the new kid who walks onto a playground. And I have retained the race element of it. So it's an all-white school. He walks on, he's black, his father is from Ghana, he's a diplomat, and it's set over the course of one school day. So he ends up meeting this girl, Dee, and this bully, the bully of the school, Ian, notices all this and is jealous and decides to play mess it up, mess things up. And it's a lot of fun to write a story that you are actually already know, well, sort of know the ending. I'm not sure if I'm going to have her die or not. I'm not sure it's necessary. You know, it's like the child's version of death. Mm. What would that be? Mm. Being socially outcast or falling from the monkey bars? I don't know. I don't know. We have to figure
unfriended
it out.
Unfriended on Facebook.
Yeah, if it were now, but it's 1973, yeah. So I'll have to figure something out. But it's been really fascinating writing it, and also for once setting it, although I suppose you could say 1973 is historical. For me, it's right when I was growing up, so I don't have to do research in the same way. Mm. It's kind of wonderful. I'm just remembering all the candy, the different kinds of candy I had, what I wore, the kind of pencils we had, what our desks were like, what we did at recess, the kind of games we played. It's a lot of fun.
Mm. And I just wonder before we go, if you have thought about how you would like to be remembered.
Oh, I haven't really thought about that, because it's a therein lies madness trying to figure out whether you're leaving behind a legacy. I think I'm always at my happiest when a reader says to me, I stayed up till 3 a.m. to find out how this book finished. And that's what I one on my grave. She kept him up late.
Tracy Chevalier, I'm sure you'll be keeping most of us up late, particularly if we pick up at the edge of the orchard. Thank you so much for coming in to speak to me. Your new book, out now, published by Burra Press. You've been listening to Meet the Writers, thanks to the production team of Claire Urban and Toby Hammond. You can download the show and previous episodes from our website or app, from SoundCloud, Mixcloud, or iTunes. I'm Georgina Godwin. Thank you for listening.